them from this Indian counterpart of Nimrod. And he had sent demons after him. Putana of the poisoned milk was the first, but all had been undone. Now, when his devices had failed, Kantz determined to lure the youths to his city. A messenger was sent to invite the cowherds to a sacrifice and great tournament. The invitation was accepted. With the brothers among them, the cowherds came and camped outside the city wall. Krishna and Balarama, his brother, went in to see the wonders of the town. There were great gardens, palaces, and groves. They encountered a washerman and asked him for some fine clothes. When he laughed and refused, they took the clothes by force and made themselves very gay. Then a humpbacked woman prayed Krishna to let her rub sandal paste on his body. He went up to her, placing his feet on hers, and with two fingers beneath her chin, lifted her up and made her straight and fair. And he said, "When I have slain Kants, I shall come back and be with you." The brothers came to the empty stadium. There the bow of the god Shiva was set up, huge as three palm trees, great and heavy. Krishna advanced to the bow, pulled it, and it broke with a mighty noise. Kants in his palace heard the sound and was appalled. The tyrant sent his troops to kill the brothers in the city, but the lads slew the soldiers and returned to their camp. They told the cowherds they had had an interesting tour, then ate their suppers and went to bed. Kants that night had ominous dreams. When he woke, he ordered the stadium prepared for the tournament and the trumpets blown for assembly. Krishna and Balarama arrived as jugglers, followed by the cowherds, their friends. When they entered the gate, there was a furious elephant ready to crush them, mighty as 10,000 common elephants. The driver rode it directly at Krishna. Balarama gave it such a blow with his fist that it halted, started back. The driver rode it again, but the two brothers struck it to the ground, and it was dead. The youths walked onto the field. Everybody saw what his own nature revealed to him. The wrestlers thought Krishna a wrestler. The women thought him the treasure of beauty. The gods knew him as their lord. And Kants thought he was Mara, death himself. When he had undone every one of the wrestlers sent against him, slaying finally the strongest, he leapt to the royal dais, dragged the tyrant by the hair, and killed him. Men, gods, and saints were delighted. But the king's wives came forth to mourn. Krishna, seeing their grief, comforted them with his primal wisdom. "Mother," he said, "do not grieve. No one can live and not die. To imagine oneself as possessing anything is to be mistaken. Nobody is father, mother, or son. There is only the continuous round of birth and death." The legends of the Redeemer describe the period of desolation as caused by a moral fault on the part of man. Adam in the garden, Jamshid on the throne. Yet from the standpoint of the cosmogonic cycle, a regular alternation of fair and foul is characteristic of the spectacle of time. Just as in the history of the universe, so also in that of nations. Emanation leads to dissolution, youth to age, birth to death, form creative vitality to the dead weight of inertia. Life surges, precipitating forms, and then ebbs, leaving jetsam behind. The Golden Age, the reign of the world emperor, alternates in the pulse of every moment of life with the wasteland, the reign of the tyrant. The god who is the creator becomes the destroyer in the end. From this point of view, the tyrant ogre is no less representative of the father than the earlier world emperor, whose position he usurped, or than the brilliant hero, the son, who is to supplant him. He is the representative of the set fast, as the hero is the carrier of the changing. And since every moment of time bursts free from the fetters of the moment before, So this dragon, Holdfast, is pictured as of the generation immediately preceding that of the Savior of the world. Stated in direct terms, the work of the hero is to slay the tenacious aspect of the father, dragon, tester, ogre king, and release from its ban the vital energies that will feed the universe.
This can be done either in accordance with the father's will or against his will. He, the father, may choose death for his children's sake, or it may be that the gods impose the passion upon him, making him their sacrificial victim. These are not contradictory doctrines, but different ways of telling one and the same story. In reality, slayer and dragon, sacrificer and victim, are of one mind behind the scenes, where there is no polarity of contraries, but mortal enemies on the stage, where the everlasting war of the gods and the titans is displayed. In any case, the dragon father remains a pleroma, no more diminished by what he exhales than he is increased by what he repossesses. He is the death, on whom our life depends. And to the question, is death one or many, the answer is made that he is one as he is there, but many as he is in his children here.
The hero of yesterday becomes the tyrant of tomorrow, unless he crucifies himself today. From the point of view of the present, there is such a recklessness in this deliverance of the future that it appears to be nihilistic. The words of Krishna, the world savior, to the wives of the dead Kants carry a frightening overtone. So do the words of Jesus, "I came not to send peace, but a sword, for I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's foes shall be they of his own household. He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." To protect the unprepared, mythology veils such ultimate revelations under half-obscuring guises, while yet insisting on the gradually instructive form. The savior figure who eliminates the tyrant father and then himself assumes the crown is, like Oedipus, stepping into his sire's stead. To soften the harsh patricide, the legend represents the father as some cruel uncle or usurping Nimrod. Nevertheless, the half-hidden fact remains. Once it is glimpsed, the entire spectacle buckles. The son slays the father, but the son and the father are one. The enigmatical figures dissolve back into the primal chaos. This is the wisdom of the end and re-beginning of the world. 7. The hero as saint. Before we proceed to the last episode of the life, one more hero type remains to be mentioned, the saint or ascetic, the world renouncer.
Endowed with a pure understanding, restraining the self with firmness, turning away from sound and other objects, and abandoning love and hatred, dwelling in solitude, eating but little, controlling the speech, body, and mind, ever engaged in meditation and concentration, and cultivating freedom from passion, forsaking conceit and power, pride and lust, wrath and possessions, tranquil in heart and free from ego, he becomes worthy of becoming one with the imperishable.
The pattern is that of going to the Father, but to the unmanifest rather than the manifest aspect, taking the step that the Bodhisattva renounced, that from which there is no return. Not the paradox of the dual perspective, but the ultimate claim of the unseen is here intended. The ego is burnt out. Like a dead leaf in a breeze, the body continues to move about the earth, but the soul has dissolved already in the ocean of bliss. Thomas Aquinas, as the result of a mystical experience while celebrating Mass in Naples, put his pen and ink on the shelf and left the last chapters of his Summa Theologica to be completed by another hand. "My writing days," he stated, "are over. For such things have been revealed to me that all I have written and taught seems of but small account to me. Wherefore I hope in my God that, even as the end has come to my teaching, so it may soon come in my life." Shortly thereafter, in his 49th year, he died. Beyond life, these heroes are beyond the myth also. Neither do they treat of it any more, nor can the myth properly treat of them. Their legends are rehearsed, but the pious sentiments and lessons of the biographies are necessarily inadequate, little better than bathos. They have stepped away from the realm of forms into which the incarnation descends and in which the bodhisattva remains, the realm of the manifest profile of the great face. Once the hidden profile has been discovered, myth is the penultimate, silence the ultimate word. The moment the spirit passes to the hidden, silence alone remains. King Oedipus came to know that the woman he had married was his mother, the man he had slain, his father. He plucked his eyes out and wandered in penance over the earth. The Freudians declare that each of us is slaying his father, marrying his mother, all the time, only unconsciously. The roundabout symbolic ways of doing this, and the rationalizations of the consequent compulsive activity, constitute our individual lives and common civilization. Should the feelings chance to become aware of the real import of the world's acts and thoughts, one would know what Oedipus knew. The flesh would suddenly appear to be an ocean of self-violation. This is the sense of the legend of Pope Gregory the Great, born of incest, living in incest. Aghast, he flees to a rock in the sea, and there does penance for his very life. The tree has now become the cross. The white youth, sucking milk, has become the crucified, swallowing gall. Corruption crawls where before was the blossom of spring. Yet beyond this threshold of the cross, for the cross is a way, the sun door, not an end, is beatitude in God.
He has placed his seal upon me that I may prefer no love to him. The winter has passed, the turtle dove sings, the vineyards burst into blossom. With his own ring my Lord Jesus Christ has wed me and crowned me with a crown as his bride. The robe with which the Lord has clothed me is a robe of splendor with gold interwove, and the necklace with which he had adorned me is beyond all price.
8. Departure of the Hero. The last act in the biography of the hero is that of the death or departure. Here the whole sense of the life is epitomized. Needless to say, the hero would be no hero if death held for him any terror. The first condition is reconciliation with the grave.
While sitting under the oak of Mamre, Abraham perceived a flashing of light and a smell of sweet odor, and turning around, he saw death coming toward him in great glory and beauty. And death said unto Abraham, "Think not, Abraham, that this beauty is mine, or that I come thus to every man. Nay, but if anyone is righteous like thee, I thus take a crown and come to him. But if he is a sinner, I come in great corruption. And out of their sins I make a crown for my head, and I shake them with great fear, so that they are dismayed." Abraham said to him, "And art thou indeed he that is called Death?" He answered and said, "I am the bitter name." But Abraham answered, "I will not go with thee." And Abraham said to Death, show us thy corruption. And death revealed his corruption, showing two heads. The one had the face of a serpent, the other head was like a sword. All the servants of Abraham, looking at the fierce mien of death, died. But Abraham prayed to the Lord, and he raised them up. As the looks of death were not able to cause Abraham's soul to depart from him, God removed the soul of Abraham as in a dream, and the archangel Michael took it up into heaven. After great praise and glory had been given to the Lord by the angels who brought Abraham's soul, and after Abraham bowed down to worship, then came the voice of God, saying thus, "Take my friend Abraham into paradise. Where are the tabernacles of my righteous ones, and the abodes of my saints, Isaac and Jacob in his bosom, where there is no trouble, nor grief, nor sighing, but peace and rejoicing and life unending."
Compare the following dream.
I was on a bridge where I met a blind fiddler. Everyone was tossing coins into his hat. I came closer and perceived that the musician was not blind. He had a squint and was looking at me with a crooked glance from the side. Suddenly there was a little old woman sitting at the side of a road. It was dark and I was afraid. "Where does this road lead?" I thought. A young peasant came along the road and took me by the hand. "Do you want to come home?" he said, "and drink coffee?" "Let me go! You are holding too tight," I cried, and awoke.
The hero, who in his life represented the dual perspective, after his death is still a synthesizing image. Like Charlemagne, he sleeps only and will arise in the hour of destiny, or he is among us under another form. The Aztecs tell of the feathered serpent Quetzalcoatl, monarch of the ancient city of Tlalan in the golden age of its prosperity. He was the teacher of the arts, originator of the calendar, and the giver of maize. He and his people were overcome at the closing of their time by the stronger magic of an invading race, the Aztecs. Tezcatlipoca, the warrior hero of the younger people and their era, broke the city of Tlalan. And the feathered serpent, king of the golden age, burned his dwellings behind him, buried his treasures in the mountains, transformed his chocolate trees into mesquite, commanded the multicolored birds, his servants, to fly before him, and departed in great sorrow. And he came to a city called Cuautitlan, where there was a tree, very tall and large. And he went over to the tree, sat down beneath it, and gazed into a mirror that was brought to him. "I am old," he said, and the place was named the Old Cuautitlan. Resting again at another place along the way, and looking back in the direction of his Tlalan, he wept, and his tears went through a rock. He left in that place the mark of his sitting and the impress of his palms. He was met and challenged, further along, by a group of necromancers, who prohibited him from proceeding until he had left with them the knowledge of working silver, wood, and feathers, and the art of painting. As he crossed the mountains, all of his attendants, who were dwarfs and humpbacks, died of cold. At another place he encountered his antagonist, Tezcatlipoca, who defeated him at a game of ball. At still another, he aimed with an arrow at a large pochitl tree. The arrow, too, was an entire pochitl tree, so that when he shot it through the first, they formed a cross. And so he passed along, leaving many signs and place names behind him, until, coming at last to the sea, he departed on a raft of serpents. It is not known how he arrived at his destination, Tlapayan, his original home. Or, according to another tradition, at the shore he immolated himself upon a funeral pyre, and birds with multicolored feathers arose from his ashes. his soul became the morning star. The life-eager hero can resist death and postpone his fate for a certain time. It is written that Cuchulainn, in his sleep, heard a cry so terrible and fearful that he fell out of his bed upon the ground like a sack in the east wing of the house. He rushed forth without weapons, followed by Aymer, his wife, who carried his arms and garments. And he discovered a chariot harnessed with a chestnut horse that had but one leg, the pole passing through its body and out at the forehead. Within sat a woman, her eyebrows red, and a crimson mantle round her. A very big man walked along beside, also in a coat of crimson, carrying a forked staff of hazelwood, and driving a cow. Cuchulainn claimed the cow as his own. The woman challenged him, and Cuchulainn then demanded to know why she was speaking instead of the big man. She answered that the man was Wargaith Shio, Lukir Shio. "Well, to be sure," said Cuchulainn, "the length of the name is astonishing." "The woman to whom you speak," said the big man, "is called Fabor Begbe Yoel, Kumjer Folt Skubgairit Shio Uwa." "You are making a fool of me," said Cuchulainn, and he made a leap into the chariot, put his 2 feet on her 2 shoulders and his spear on the parting of her hair. "Do not play your sharp weapons on me," she said. "Then tell me your true name," said Cuchulainn. "Go further off from me then," said she. "I am a female satirist, and I carry off this cow as a reward for a poem." "Let us hear your poem," said Cuchulainn. "Only move further off," said the woman. "Your shaking over my head will not influence me." Cuchulainn moved off until he was between the 2 wheels of the chariot. The woman sang at him a song of challenge and insult. He prepared to spring again, but in an instant, horse, woman, chariot, man, and cow had disappeared, and on the branch of a tree was a black bird. "A dangerous enchanted woman you are," said Cuchulainn to the black bird, for he now realized that she was the battle goddess Bibe, or Morrigan. "If I had only known that it was you, we should not have parted thus." "What you have done," replied the bird, "will bring you ill luck." "You cannot harm me," said Cuchulainn. "Certainly I can," said the woman. "I am guarding your deathbed, and I shall be guarding it henceforth." Then the enchantress told him that she was taking the cow from the fairy hill of Cruachan to be bred by the bull of the big man, who was Kolnya, and when her calf was 1 year old, Cuchulainn would die. She herself would come against him when he would be engaged at a certain ford with a man as strong, as victorious, as dexterous, as terrible, as untiring, as noble, as brave, as great as himself. "I will become an eel," she said, "and I will throw a noose round thy feet in the ford." Cuchulainn exchanged threats with her, and she disappeared into the ground. But the following year, at the foretold foray at the ford, he overcame her, and actually lived to die another day. A curious, perhaps playful echo of the symbolism of salvation in a yonder world dimly sounds in the final passage of the Pueblo folktale of Water Jar Boy.
A lot of people were living down inside the spring, women and girls. They all ran to the boy and put their arms around him because they were glad their child had come to their house. Thus, the boy found his father and his aunts, too. Well, the boy stayed there one night, and next day he went back home and told his mother he had found his father. Then his mother got sick and died. Then the boy said to himself, "No use for me to live with these people." So he left them and went to the spring. And there was his mother. That was the way he and his mother went to live with his father. His father was Avayopi, water snake red. He said he could not live with them over at Sikyatki. That was the reason he made the boy's mother sick, so she died, and came over here to live with me, said his father. Now we will live here together, said Avayo to his son. That's the way that boy and his mother went to the spring to live there.
This story, like that of the clam wife, repeats point for point the mythical narrative. The two stories are charming in their apparent innocence of their power. At the opposite extreme is the account of the death of the Buddha, humorous like all great myth, but conscious to the last degree.
The Blessed One, accompanied by a large congregation of priests, drew near to the further bank of the Hiranavati River and to the city of Kusinara and the sal tree grove Upavatana of the Malas, and having drawn near, he addressed the Venerable Ananda. Be so good, Ananda, as to spread me a couch with its head to the north, between twin sal trees. I am weary, Ananda, and wish to lie down. Yes, Reverend Sir, said the Venerable Ananda to the Blessed One in assent, and spread the couch with its head to the north between twin sal trees. Then the Blessed One lay down on his right side, after the manner of a lion, and placing foot on foot, remained mindful and conscious. Now at that time, the twin sal trees had completely burst forth into bloom, though it was not the flowering season, and the blossoms scattered themselves over the body of the Tathagata, and strewed and sprinkled themselves in worship of the Tathagata. Also heavenly sandalwood powder fell from the sky, and this scattered itself over the body of the Tathagata, and strewed and sprinkled itself in worship of the Tathagata. And music sounded in the sky in worship of the Tathagata, and heavenly choruses were heard to sing in worship of the Tathagata.
During the conversations which then took place, as the Tathagata lay like a lion on his side, a large priest, the Venerable Upavana, stood in front, fanning him. The Blessed One briefly ordered him to step aside, whereupon the body attendant of the Blessed One, Ananda, complained to the Blessed One. Reverend Sir, he said, what, pray, was the reason, and what was the cause that the Blessed One was harsh to the Venerable Upavana, saying, Step aside, O priest, stand not in front of me? The Blessed One replied,
Ananda, almost all the deities throughout 10 worlds have come together to behold the Tathagata. For an extent, Ananda, of 12 leagues about the city Kusinara and the sal tree grove Upavatana of the Malas, there is not a spot of ground large enough to stick the point of a hair into that is not pervaded by powerful deities. And these deities, Ananda, are angered, saying, From afar have we come to behold the Tathagata, for but seldom and on rare occasions does a Tathagata, a saint, and Supreme Buddha arise in the world. And now, tonight, in the last watch, will the Tathagata pass into Nirvana. But this powerful priest stands in front of the Blessed One, concealing him, and we have no chance to see the Tathagata, although his last moments are near. Thus, Ananda, are these deities angered. What are the deities doing, Reverend Sir, whom the Blessed One perceives? Some of the deities, Ananda, are in the air with their minds engrossed by earthly things, and they let fly their hair and cry aloud, and stretch out their arms and cry aloud, and fall headlong to the ground and roll to and fro, saying, All too soon will the Blessed One pass into Nirvana. All too soon will the light of the world vanish from sight. Some of the deities, Ananda, are on the earth with their minds engrossed by earthly things, and they let fly their hair and cry aloud, and stretch out their arms and cry aloud, and fall headlong to the ground and roll to and fro, saying, All too soon will the Blessed One pass into Nirvana, all too soon will the Happy One pass into Nirvana, all too soon will the light of the world vanish from sight. But those deities which are free from passion, mindful and conscious, bear it patiently, saying, Transitory are all things. How is it possible that whatever has been born, has come into being, and is organized and perishable, should not perish? That condition is not possible.
The last conversations continued for some time, and during the course of them, the Blessed One gave consolation to his priests. Then he addressed them. And now, O priests, I take my leave of you. All the constituents of being are transitory. Work out your salvation with diligence. And this was the last word of the Tathagata.
Thereupon the Blessed One entered the first trance, and rising from the first trance, he entered the second trance, and rising from the second trance, he entered the third trance, and rising from the third trance, he entered the fourth trance, and rising from the fourth trance, he entered the realm of the infinity of space, and rising from the realm of the infinity of space, he entered the realm of the infinity of consciousness. And rising from the realm of the infinity of consciousness, he entered the realm of nothingness. And rising from the realm of nothingness, he entered the realm of neither perception nor yet non-perception. And rising from the realm of neither perception nor yet non-perception, he arrived at the cessation of perception and sensation. Thereupon the Venerable Ananda spoke to the Venerable Anuruddha as follows. Reverend Anuruddha, the Blessed One has passed into Nirvana. Nay, Brother Ananda, the Blessed One has not yet passed into Nirvana. He has arrived at the cessation of perception and sensation. Thereupon the Blessed One, rising from the cessation of his perception and sensation, entered the realm of neither perception nor yet non-perception. And rising from the realm of neither perception nor yet non-perception, he entered the realm of nothingness. And rising from the realm of nothingness, he entered the realm of infinity of consciousness. And rising from the realm of infinity of consciousness, he entered the realm of the infinity of space. And rising from the realm of the infinity of space, he entered the fourth trance. And rising from the fourth trance, he entered the third trance. And rising from the third trance, he entered the second trance. And rising from the second trance, he entered the first trance. And rising from the first trance, he entered the second trance. And rising from the second trance, he entered the third trance. And rising from the third trance, he entered the fourth trance. And rising from the fourth trance, immediately, the Blessed One passed into Nirvana.
Chapter 4. Dissolutions. 1. End of the Microcosm. The mighty hero of extraordinary powers, able to lift Mount Govardhan on a finger and to fill himself with the terrible glory of the universe, is each of us. Not the physical self visible in the mirror, but the king within. Krishna declares, I am the self, seated in the hearts of all creatures. I am the beginning, the middle, and the end of all beings. This, precisely, is the sense of the prayers for the dead. At the moment of personal dissolution, that the individual should now return to his pristine knowledge of the world creative divinity who during life was reflected within his heart.
When he comes to weakness, whether he come to weakness through old age or through disease, this person frees himself from these limbs just as a mango or a fig or a berry releases itself from its bond. And he hastens again, according to the entrance and place of origin, back to life. As noblemen, policemen, chariot drivers, village heads wait with food, drink, and lodgings for a king who is coming, and cry, "Here he comes! Here he comes!" So indeed do all things wait for him who has this knowledge, and cry, "Here is the imperishable coming! Here is the imperishable coming!"
The idea is sounded already in the coffin texts of ancient Egypt, where the dead man sings of himself as one with God.
"I am Atum, I who was alone. I am Re at his first appearance. I am the great God, self-generator, who fashioned his names, Lord of gods, whom none approaches among the gods. I was yesterday, I know tomorrow. The battlefield of the gods was made when I spoke. I know the name of that great God who is therein. Praise of Re is his name. I am that great phoenix which is in Heliopolis."
But, as in the death of the Buddha, the power to make a full transit back through the epochs of emanation depends on the character of the man when he was alive. The myths tell of a dangerous journey of the soul, with obstacles to be passed. The Eskimos in Greenland enumerate a boiling kettle, a pelvis bone, a large burning lamp, monster guardians, and two rocks that strike together and open again. Such elements are standard features of world folklore and heroic legend. We have discussed them above in our chapters of The Adventure of the Hero. They have received their most elaborate and significant development in the mythology of the soul's last journey. An Aztec prayer to be said at the deathbed warns the departed of the dangers along the way back to the skeleton god of the dead, Tzontemoc, he of the falling hair.
"Dear child, thou hast passed through and survived the labors of this life. Now it hath pleased our Lord to carry thee away, for we do not enjoy this world everlastingly, only briefly. Our life is like the warming of oneself in the sun, and the Lord hath conferred on us the blessing of knowing and conversing with each other in this existence. But now, at this moment, the God who is called Mictlantecuhtli, or Aconcagua, or again Tzontemoc, and the goddess known as Mictlantecuhtli, have transported thee away. Thou art brought before his seat. For we all must go there. That place is intended for us all, and it is vast. We are to have of thee no further recollection. Thou wilt reside in that place most dark, where there is neither light nor window. Thou wilt not return or depart from thence, nor wilt thou think about or concern thyself with the matter of return. Thou wilt be absent from among us for evermore. Poor and orphaned hast thou left thy children, thy grandchildren, nor dost thou know how they will end, how they will pass through the labors of this life. As for ourselves, we shall soon be going there where thou art to be."
The Aztec ancients and officials prepared the body for the funeral, and when they had properly wrapped it, took a little water and poured it on the head, saying to the deceased, "This thou didst enjoy when thou wert living in the world." And they took a small jug of water and presented it to him, saying, "Here is something for thy journey." They set it in the fold of his shroud. Then they wrapped the deceased in his blankets, secured him strongly, and placed before him, one at a time, certain papers that had been prepared. Lo, with this thou wilt be able to go between the mountains that clash. With this thou wilt pass along the road where the serpent watcheth. This will satisfy the little green lizard, Hochitonal. And behold, with this thou wilt make the transit of the 8 deserts of freezing cold. Here is that by which thou wilt go across the 8 small hills. Here is that by which thou wilt survive the wind of the obsidian knives. The departed was to take a little dog with him, of bright reddish hair. Around its neck they placed a soft thread of cotton. They killed it and cremated it with the corpse. The departed swam on this small animal when he passed the river of the underworld. And after 4 years of passage, he arrived with it before the god, to whom he presented his papers and gifts. Whereupon he was admitted, together with his faithful companion, to the 9th abyss.
White dogs and black cannot swim the river, because the white would say, I have washed myself, and the black, I have soiled myself. Only the bright reddish ones can pass to the shore of the dead.
The Chinese tell of a crossing of the ferry bridge under guidance of the Jade Maiden and the Golden Youth. The Hindus picture a towering firmament of heavens and a many-leveled underworld of hells. The soul gravitates after death to the story appropriate to its relative density, there to digest and assimilate the whole meaning of its past life. When the lesson has been learned, it returns to the world to prepare itself for the next degree of experience. Thus, gradually, it makes its way through all the levels of life value until it is broken past the confines of the cosmic egg. Dante's Divina Commedia is an exhaustive review of the stages. Inferno, the misery of the spirit bound to the prides and actions of the flesh. Purgatorio, the process of transmuting fleshly into spiritual experience. Paradiso, the degrees of spiritual realization. A deep and awesome vision of the journey is that of the Egyptian Book of the Dead. The man or woman who has died is identified with and actually called Osiris. The texts open with hymns of praise to Re and Osiris, and then proceed to the mysteries of the unswathing of the spirit in the world beneath. In the chapter of giving a mouth to Osiris N, we read the phrase, I rise out of the egg in the hidden land, where N appears, the name of the deceased is given, viz., Osiris Ofonk, Osiris Ani. This is the announcement of the idea of death as a rebirth. Then, in the chapter of opening the mouth of Osiris N, the awakening spirit prays, May the god Ptah open my mouth, and may the god of my city loose the swathings, even the swathings which are over my mouth. The chapter of making Osiris N to possess memory in the underworld, and the chapter of giving a heart to Osiris N in the underworld, carry the process of rebirth 2 stages further. Then begin the chapters of the dangers that the lone voyager has to face and overcome on his way to the throne of the awesome judge. The Book of the Dead was buried with the mummy as a guidebook to the perils of the difficult way, and chapters were recited at the time of burial. At one stage in the preparation of the mummy, the heart of the dead man was cut open, and a basalt scarab in a gold setting, symbolic of the sun, was placed therein with the prayer, My heart, my mother, my heart, my mother, my heart of transformations. This is prescribed in the chapter of not letting the heart of Osiris N be taken from him in the underworld. Next we read, in the chapter of beating back the crocodile.
Get thee back, O crocodile that dwellest in the west. Get thee back, O crocodile that dwellest in the south. Get thee back, O crocodile that dwellest in the north. The things which are created are in the hollow of my hand. and those which have not yet come into being are in my body. I am clothed and wholly provided with thy magical words, O Rei, the which are in heaven above me and in the earth beneath me.
The chapter of repulsing serpents follows, then the chapter of driving away Apshet. The soul cries at the latter demon, Depart from me, O thou who hast lips that gnaw. In the chapter of driving back the two Murti goddesses, the soul declares its purpose and protects itself by stating its claim to be the son of the Father. I shine from the Sektet boat. I am Horus, the son of Osiris, and I have come to see my father, Osiris. The chapter of living by air in the underworld, and the chapter of driving back the serpent Rerek in the underworld, carry the hero still further along his way. And then comes the great proclamation of the chapter of driving away the slaughterings which are performed in the underworld.
My hair is the hair of Nu. My face is the face of the disk. My eyes are the eyes of Hathor. My ears are the ears of Apuat. My nose is the nose of Kentikas. My lips are the lips of Anpu. My teeth are the teeth of Serget. My neck is the neck of the divine goddess Isis. My hands are the hands of Ban-Neb-Tattu. My forearms are the forearms of Naith, the lady of Sais. My backbone is the backbone of Suti. My phallus is the phallus of Osiris. My loins are the loins of the lords of Ker-Abba. My chest is the chest of the mighty one of Terra. There is no member of my body that is not the member of some god. The god Thoth shieldeth my body altogether, and I am Rei, day by day. I shall not be dragged back by the arms, and none shall lay violent hold upon my hands.
As in the much later Buddhist image of the Bodhisattva, within whose nimbus stand 500 transformed Buddhas, each attended by 500 Bodhisattvas, and each of these in turn by innumerable gods, so here the soul comes to the fullness of its stature and power, through assimilating the deities that formerly had been thought to be separate from and outside of it. They are projections of its own being, and as it returns to its true state, they are all reassumed. In the chapter of snuffing the air and of having the mastery over the water of the underworld, the soul proclaims itself to be the guardian of the cosmic egg. Hail, thou sycamore tree of the goddess Nut! Grant thou to me of the water and of the air which dwell in thee. I embrace the throne which is in Hermopolis, and I watch and guard the egg of the great cackler. It groweth, I grow. It liveth, I live. It snuffeth the air, I snuff the air. I, the Osiris N, in triumph. There followed the chapter of not letting the soul of a man be taken from him in the underworld, and the chapter of drinking water in the underworld, and of not being burnt by fire. And then we come to the great culmination, the chapter of coming forth by day in the underworld, wherein the soul and the universal being are known to be one.
I am yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And I have the power to be born a second time. I am the divine, hidden soul, who createth the gods, and who giveth sepulchral meals unto the denizens of the underworld of Amentet and of heaven. I am the rudder of the east, the possessor of two divine faces, wherein his beams are seen. I am the Lord of the men who are raised up, the Lord who cometh forth out of darkness, and whose forms of existence are of the house wherein are the dead. Hail, ye two hawks, who are perched upon your resting places, who hearken unto the things which are said by him, who guide the bier to the hidden place, who lead along Rei, and who follow him into the uppermost place of the shrine which is in the celestial heights. Hail, Lord of the shrine which standeth in the middle of the earth, He is I, and I am he, and Ptah hath covered his sky with crystal.
Thereafter, the soul may range the universe at will, as is shown in the chapter of lifting up the feet and of coming forth upon the earth, the chapter of journeying to Heliopolis and of receiving a throne therein, the chapter of a man transforming himself into whatever form he pleaseth, the chapter of entering into the great house, and the chapter of going into the presence of the divine sovereign princes of Osiris. The chapters of the so-called negative confession declare the moral purity of the man who has been redeemed. I have not done iniquity. I have not robbed with violence. I have not done violence to any man. I have not committed theft. I have not slain man or woman. The book concludes with addresses of praise of the gods, and then the chapter of living nigh unto Re, the chapter of causing a man to come back to see his house upon earth, the chapter of making perfect the soul, and the chapter of sailing in the great sunboat of Re. 2. End of the macrocosm. As the created form of the individual must dissolve, so that of the universe also.
When it is known that after the lapse of 100,000 years, the cycle is to be renewed, the gods called Lokabuhas, inhabitants of a heaven of sensual pleasure, wander about through the world, with hair let down and flying in the wind, weeping and wiping away their tears with their hands, and with their clothes red and in great disorder. And thus they make announcement. Sirs, after the lapse of 100,000 years, the cycle is to be renewed. This world will be destroyed. Also, the mighty ocean will dry up, and this broad earth, and Sumeru, the monarch of the mountains, will be burnt up and destroyed. Up to the Brahma world will the destruction of the world extend. Therefore, sirs, cultivate friendliness, cultivate compassion, joy, and indifference. Wait on your mothers, wait on your fathers, and honor your elders among your kinsfolk. This is called the cyclic uproar.
The Mayan version of the world end is represented in an illustration covering the last page of the Dresden Codex. This ancient manuscript records the cycles of the planets and from those deduces calculations of vast cosmic cycles. The serpent numbers which appear toward the close of the text, so-called because of the appearance in them of a serpent symbol, represent world periods of some 34,000 years, 12.5 million days, and these are recorded again and again.
In these well-nigh inconceivable periods, all the smaller units may be regarded as coming at last to a more or less exact close. What matter a few score years one way or the other in this virtual eternity? Finally, on the last page of the manuscript is depicted the destruction of the world, for which the highest numbers have paved the way. Here we see the rain serpent, stretching across the sky, belching forth torrents of water. Great streams of water gush from the sun and moon. The old goddess, she of the tiger claws and forbidding aspect, the malevolent patroness of floods and cloudbursts, overturns the bowl of the heavenly waters. The crossbones, dread symbol of death, decorate her skirt, and a writhing snake crowns her head. Below, with downward pointed spear, symbolic of the universal destruction, the black god stalks abroad, a screeching owl raging on his fearsome head. Here, indeed, is portrayed with graphic touch the final all-engulfing cataclysm.
One of the strongest representations appears in the poetic Edda of the ancient Vikings. Othon Votan, the chief of the gods, has asked to know what will be the doom of himself and his pantheon, and the wise woman, a personification of the World Mother herself, destiny articulate, lets him hear.
Brothers shall fight and fell each other, and sisters' sons shall kinship stain. Hard is it on earth, with mighty whoredom, axe time, sword time, shields are sundered, wind time, wolf time, ere the world falls, nor ever shall men each other spare.
In the land of the giants, Jotunheim, a fair red rooster shall crow. In Valhalla, the rooster golden comb, a rust-red bird in hell. The dog Garm at the cliff cave, the entrance to the world of the dead, shall open his great jaws and howl. The earth shall tremble, the crags and trees be torn asunder, the sea gush forth upon the land. The fetters of those monsters who were chained back in the beginning shall all burst. Fenris Wolf shall run free and advance with lower jaw against the earth, upper against the heavens. He would gape yet more, if there were room for it. Fires shall blaze from his eyes and nostrils. The world-enveloping serpent of the cosmic ocean shall rise in giant wrath and advance beside the wolf upon the land, blowing venom, so that it shall sprinkle all the air and water. Naglfar shall be loosed, the ship made of dead men's nails, and this shall be the transport of the giants. Another ship shall sail with the inhabitants of hell, and the people of fire shall advance from the south. When the watchmen of the gods shall blow the shrieking horn, the warrior sons of Othin will be summoned to the final battle. From all quarters the gods, giants, demons, dwarfs, and elves will be riding for the field. The world ash, Yggdrasil, will tremble, and nothing then be without fear in heaven and earth. Othin shall advance against the wolf, Thor against the serpent, Tyr against the dog, the worst monster of all, and Freyr against Surt, the man of flame. Thor shall slay the serpent, stride 10 paces from that spot, and because of the venom blown, fall dead to the earth. Othin shall be swallowed by the wolf, and thereafter Vidar, setting 1 foot upon the lower jaw, shall take the upper jaw of the wolf in his hand, and tear asunder the gullet. Loki shall slay Heimdallr, and be slain by him. Surt shall cast fire over the earth, and burn all the world.
The sun turns black. Earth sinks in the sea. The hot stars down from heaven are whirled. Fierce grows the steam and the life-feeding flame, till fire leaps high about heaven itself. Now Garm howls loud before Gnipa Hetlir. The fetters will burst, and the wolf run free. Much do I know, and more can see, of the fate of the gods, the mighty in fight.
This vision of apocalypse comes to us from the Gospel according to Matthew.
And as Jesus sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming, and of the end of the world? And Jesus answered and said unto them, Take heed, that no man deceive you. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. And ye shall hear of wars, and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass. But the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in divers places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and ye shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another. And many false prophets shall rise, and shall deceive many. And because iniquity shall abound, The love of many shall wax cold. But he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations. And then shall the end come. When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of,